This week on Your Western Context, we look into the results of the election on Monday, leading to a hung parliament and the growing discontent in the West known as Wexit. Also, BC implements a bill recognizing UNDRIP, and Alberta tables its budget, forecasting a return to balance. This is Western Context, episode 141, recorded Friday, October 25th, 2019. A Country Divided. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. We're back this week with the post-mortem episode of Canada's 2019 election, and we're going to go through all the news of the week, but hopefully you guys are recovering from that election, and we're just going to go through the news as we do each and every week, and as we have been doing since January of 2017.
Yes, that's right. We've been doing this for almost 3 years now, and I think this episode was probably long awaited to be able to talk about the results of the election. Certainly a lot of people have done our talking before we've gotten a chance to, given that the election was on Monday, and the media has certainly had their chance to throw their narrative on what happened in the election, and coming up we'll have our opportunity to do that as well.
Indeed, and you know, we're going to do it in the same way we always do it, looking at what the media says, all angles of the media, and removing that bias and sensationalism, and hopefully providing all the information and context out there to you, the listeners, to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So let's begin and look at what happened on Monday.
Well, Monday night was our federal election, and for those who have somehow not heard about it yet, you'll hear all about it right now as we go over the results. And the election gave us a result that, rather than giving Canadians answers, I think it just gave us more questions. And I think if you're looking at it from an outside perspective, if you're an international listener or if you're American, I think the 2019 election was seen by many to be the most American style of any election we've ever had. It's been it was a very nasty 40-day campaign. There was pretty bad attack ads from all corners. We even saw the NDP going after the Green Party, which is something that I think in any election previously we haven't seen. Even over here on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, we saw numerous attack ads on the radio from the NDP that were misrepresenting what the Green Party leader said. And that's something that I never thought I would say that would actually happen. So certainly there was a lot of attack ads, certainly most of them from the Liberals to the Conservatives, or the Conservatives to the Liberals, and a lot of substance going back and forth that wasn't really unheard of outside of an American-style election, but in a Canadian election, it's usually a little bit more civil than that. But I digress. It seems like rather than focusing on policy and substance, the media itself covered style and rather the meaningless parts of leaders' personalities instead in the run-up to the election. And this is where we're at. The official results for the election were 157 seats for Trudeau's Liberals, 121 for Scheer's Conservatives, putting them as currently the official opposition. Resurgent Bloc Québécois under Yves-François Blanchet, capturing 32 seats in Quebec, and a falling NDP under Jagmeet Singh, dropping to just 24, and Elizabeth May increasing her caucus by a whopping 300% from one seat to three seats, and split away People's Party of Canada leader Maxime Bernier failed to retain his own riding by quite a large margin, and indeed did not win anywhere else at all. And it was a long night for many campaigns. Earlier in the day, polls had closed, and over here on the West Coast, we were starting to get the results in at 4 p.m., and by the time it ended up around midnight or 1 a.m. Pacific time, we still didn't see that much of, well, we certainly saw the overall result, but a lot of writing still hadn't been called yet. A lot of them were still too close to come, and there were certainly quite a few surprise wins and some major upsets throughout the night, and many races proved to be tight in ridings across the country and weren't called until later that morning after pretty much everyone had gone to bed at that point. And I think it's should be noted that none of the federal political parties hit the 170-seat threshold of a majority government, which, of course, the Liberal Party got when it stormed to power in 2015, winning 184 seats. Now, despite winning a plurality of the 338 seats in the parliament and securing their what they could be called a minority status this time around, the Liberals won the most seats, but they didn't get the majority. So they're going to have to test their confidence in Parliament when Parliament reconvenes. Now, they say that it's not going to be the new cabinet isn't going to be sworn in until November 20th, which is, you know, just under a month away. So what they're going to be doing in the meantime is anybody's guess, but we'll probably see more talk about what's going on as the days keep marching on towards that November 20th date. Now, it should be mentioned that the Liberals also lost the popular vote to the Conservatives, but still won the most seats. And this was a very popular narrative that came out during election night when people saw the Conservatives start to storm ahead in the popular vote as the votes in the West, particularly in Saskatchewan and Alberta, but also in Manitoba and BC as well, were starting to get counted, and those provinces were voting more so for the Conservatives. And indeed, the Conservatives won the popular vote by almost 300,000 Canadians, and that's quite a significant margin when you consider that the Liberals won 36 more seats than the Conservatives did. Now, for the Liberals, they lost 27 seats on Monday night compared to their 2015 election results. They got a total of 157, as I said, down from 184 in 2015, and the 177 that the party held at the dissolution of Parliament in September. Now, the Liberals didn't win any seats in Alberta or Saskatchewan, and all but two of the previous government's cabinet ministers were elected. Two of them that weren't were Ralph Goodale and Amarjeet Sohi, who lost their seats in Saskatchewan and Alberta. Now, the Conservatives, meanwhile, had a much better showing than they had in 2015. They won a total of 121 seats, up from the 99 that the party won 4 years ago and the 95 that it held at dissolution. Now, for its part, the recently embattled Bloc Québécois, who went through numerous leadership conventions and had a switch over to Yves-François Blanchet, picked up a lot of steam throughout the election campaign, especially in Quebec, and throughout the French language debate, certainly captured the hearts and minds of a lot of Quebecers, and they recovered in the election to get to 32 seats, which was much higher than their 10 seats that they won in 2015. Now, the Bloc resurgence saw the NDP lose almost all of its Quebec seats, and indeed, across the country, the NDP lost 20 seats on Monday night, and they sunk to fourth place. Now, the party won 44 seats in the 2015 election, had just 39 at dissolution, but a fourth of the caucus decided to not run again for them in this election. So they only won 24, despite experiencing a mini surge in popularity towards the end of the campaign that really didn't translate to a higher amount of vote totals. Now, the Green Party, they gained one more seat in the House of Commons with a historic breakthrough in Atlantic Canada for essentially two terms of Parliament. Leader Elizabeth May has been on her own and was just joined in a by-election by Paul Manley, who won in May 2019, and Nanaimo Ladysmith. Both of them were elected again Monday night and now are joined by Jenica Atwin, who is the new MP for Fredericton, New Brunswick. Now, former Liberal Cabinet Minister and Attorney General Jody Wilson-Raybould was the sole independent candidate elected on Monday night. Wilson-Raybould won the BC riding of Vancouver-Granville for a second time in a row, beating her Liberal and Conservative rivals in the riding's three-way race. And finally, although the New People's Party of Canada ran candidates in every riding across the country, the party failed to secure a single seat in the House of Commons. Leader Maxime Bernier, who walked out of the Conservatives to found his own party, lost his longtime riding of Beauce, Quebec, to his Tory rival, Richard Lahoux. Now, in 2019, the voter turnout dropped slightly compared to the last federal election. Elections Canada is reporting that 65.95% of eligible Canadian voters cast a ballot, which is a 2.35% drop from turnout in 2015. That number, of course, doesn't include electors who registered on election day. Based on a count of Election Canada's preliminary results, 98 women were elected or re-elected to the House of Commons on Monday night, which was up from 88 in 2015. Now, as the election was winding down, convention says that the losing party leaders speak first, in order of who had the lowest seats. Bernier ended up going first, since he had zero seats, so he gave a short concession speech, but then Bloc leader Yves-François Blanchet went next, despite being third in seats. Then Jagmeet Singh followed and had such a long-winded speech that Andrew Scheer came out to give a speech near the tail end of Singh's before he'd stopped speaking. Then, as Scheer started to give his opening remarks, Trudeau came out to undercut him by starting his speech instead. And then finally, after everything was finished and the network switched around between the speeches to make sure that everyone could actually hear everyone else speaking, Elizabeth May gave her speech at the end. Christo Avalais, who speaks or teaches Canadian politics at the University of Toronto, said it was all over the place. And Christopher Cochran, who is a political professor at U of T, said, quote, "It was unprecedented. To my knowledge, that has never happened before at the provincial or at the federal level." Cochran, who watched the speeches Monday night, said that the NDP speech was a, quote, "longer speech," and he was unsure if he would call Scheer coming out during the speech unusual. "I noted it certainly, but however," he noted that it was another matter altogether when Trudeau stepped out amidst Scheer's opening remarks, which divided national audiences. Cochran added that he didn't know if it was uncoordinated or unintentional. If it's intentional, it's unfortunate. If the PM went out intentionally to interrupt the concession speech of the opposition leader, then that's spectacularly petty. Daniel Belant, who is the director of McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, said that it doesn't paint a good scenario for Canadians. He said, quote, "especially on people staying up really late, to have them speak at the same time, it's certainly not the way it's normally done. And it certainly doesn't send a good message about how the parties will work in a minority parliament." Now, Conservative leader Andrew Scheer says he's meeting with key campaign officials to do a, quote, "thorough review of the party's election performance. He said, quote, "We made some great progress, but we need to do better next time." He said, "This is really the first step, the first important step in replacing Justin Trudeau's Liberal government." And Scheer said that the Conservatives made incredible gains in reducing the Liberals to a minority and winning the popular vote. He said the second step is to work even harder in the coming months to ensure that the Liberals are ousted next time. It should be noted that Andrew Scheer, upon losing the election, or rather not winning the most seats, he faces a mandatory leadership review, which will happen during the next Conservative Party convention, which is scheduled to take place in April of next year. Now, for his part, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau ruled out a governing coalition and said that his new minority government's new cabinet will have gender balance when it's sworn in on November 20th, which is very much like what he did in 2015. And at that time, he said the reason why it happened was because it's 2015. So who knows if on November 20th, he'll say it's because it's 2019. Trudeau said he will work with other parties, including the Bloc Québécois, to advance shared goals. But he also said that his government will continue with plans to expand the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which he said is, quote, "in Canada's best interests." It's notable to see that the NDP opposes the pipeline expansion project, as do the Bloc Québécois, even though, given that they're in Quebec, it really doesn't affect them too much. Now, the Liberals didn't elect any MPs in Alberta or Saskatchewan, as we mentioned before, which presents Trudeau with a pressing problem of regional representation for his cabinet. Trudeau has said today that he has already spoken with the premiers of both provinces and will work to see the concerns of Western Canadians are addressed by his government. However, we can already see from the election that the damage is already done. The election campaign, and indeed Trudeau's previous 4 years in power, has served to wedge different parts of the country against one another, particularly East versus West, Quebec versus the prairies, and rural versus urban. A divided country where national unity is under threat is something that Trudeau will have to deal with very quickly, and his plans to continue on as if the election never actually happened will bear watching.
The only party that truly won anything on election night was the Bloc Québécois because of the resurgence of their party in Quebec, which some people still call a separatist party. But at this point, let's be honest and just say it's a Quebec nationalist party, and they're going to be asserting their agenda with the amount of seats that they got in the House of Commons. And that's something that Canadians need to be aware of, is that Trudeau lost support everywhere, including in Quebec. The only parties to pick up seats were the Conservatives and the Bloc. Granted, the Conservatives didn't form government, but that's the way the system works. There's many talking heads on the media saying that this might be a time to examine proportional representation, or maybe it's a time for Andrew Scheer to step away. But I think the thing that most of the people in the media are missing is that they're putting the cart before the horse, because you don't win minority governments. You only have a minority government once you're able to prove you have the confidence of the House, and Trudeau will have a chance to do that with the throne speech. And, you know, with the RCMP investigation into SNC-Lavalin that was started before the campaign began and any other potential issues that could crop up, it's entirely possible that this government might not make it to its first throne speech.
Yeah, it's true. To get the cooperation, they're going to have to get have a throne speech that passes either through the NDP, who very much oppose Trans Mountain Pipeline, pass through the Bloc, which, you know, want to have more interest towards Quebec, so Trudeau will have to pander to Quebec to go through them, or the very unprecedented amount to go through the Conservatives, which, as we've seen from the election campaign, and indeed ever since 2015, have been very much opposed to pretty much everything that Trudeau has done. So the likelihood of Trudeau getting through with his agenda intact is going to be, he's going to have to work very hard for that to happen, let's just say. And I think we'll have to see who exactly supports the throne speech when it does happen. If the throne speech is passed, a lot can happen in a month's time. And as we've seen, you know, things can change very quickly.
Yeah, and you know, this is the thing we always say here at Western Context, is the network's call that somebody has won a minority government in the case in BC and now here in Canada. But, you know, it would be much better if we did adopt the tradition that the UK has, where they call it instead as a hung parliament, and they see which party can indeed ascertain the confidence of the House. The conventional wisdom here in Canada is that the party with the most seats attempts to govern, and that's what's going to happen in this case. But as with all things in Canada, we'll be watching this. And, you know, I think the thing that most people outside of Western Canada probably are not aware of is the sheer amount of angst that has risen on the prairies since Monday. And, you know, looking at it this way, 47 of 48 seats went Conservative on Monday in Alberta and Saskatchewan. We had the one NDP seat won by the NDP here in Edmonton Strathcona. And, you know, looking at the results across Saskatchewan and Alberta, you see a 70% vote for the Conservatives, and that's massive. And that speaks a lot to the way many in the West view the Liberal government. And to put it mildly, many who voted on Monday and were watching the results come in are just plain livid. The Bloc or the NDP will ultimately hold the balance of power in the new parliament, as we said. And, you know, on paper, they're both opposed to pipelines and the Western-based energy economy. And to further illustrate this divide, you see in our picture of the week, you have to look at a map. You have to go from Winnipeg all the way to Surrey, British Columbia, to find the next Liberal representative. And that says quite a bit for the Liberal Party. The Liberals, of course, were wiped out in Saskatchewan and Alberta entirely, including age-old Liberal Ralph Goodale in Saskatchewan, former Energy Minister Amarjit Sohi, and most importantly, Randy Bossineau in Edmonton Centre, who shut down the Justice Committee hearings on SNC-Lavalin. And the results in Edmonton weren't even close. Normally, Edmonton centers won by a few percentage points either way, but this time it was won by conservative challenger James Cumming by nearly 10%. So he lost his Edmonton, Millwoods riding by 17%, and Ralph Goodale was defeated by a similar margin or about 7,200 votes. The Liberals were also wiped out in Calgary, including serial groper Kent Hare. And in responding to Trudeau winning the most seats, Premier Kenney issued a written letter to Trudeau and held a news conference on Monday after issuing his statement in the Alberta legislature. In the letter, he called for access to the energy market, which of course means more pipelines, a resource corridor, which is something Andrew Scheer promised, the repeal of Bills C-48 and C-69, which are of course the Northern BC Tanker Moratorium Act and the bill that reformed the National Energy Board to make approving new pipeline projects harder. He also called on the federal government to not impose its carbon tax on Alberta, fairness in federal transfers to Alberta, a rework in the equalization program, lessening of the Canadian Mortgage and Home Corporation stress test for new homeowners on the prairies. This was a project that was brought in for homeowners in BC and Toronto with sky-high home prices, but this is actually hurting people who want to buy houses here in Alberta and Saskatchewan. Kenney also called for the lowering of interprovincial trade barriers, equal distribution of health transfers, and for the government to reverse cuts to military health care, which is something that bubbled up in the campaign and wasn't talked about enough. He also called for the new government to respect the existing relationships with Indigenous people in Alberta and across the country, and for the federal government to work with provinces to create a stronger federation for all Canadians. And recall that the Premier has previously promised to call a referendum for October of 2021 if Bill C-48 and C-69 are not repealed. And he also will hold that referendum if a carbon tax is placed on Alberta as is scheduled in the new year. Now, to address the shortage of representatives from Alberta and to get a picture of what Alberta should do next in order to fight for the province in this new order of Canada, Kenney will be appointing a panel of eminent Albertans, as he called it, in the next week. This panel will hold town halls across the province and ultimately determine which way the province should go in fighting the potential Trudeau government. Now, on election night, for anybody who watched that speech where Trudeau came out on top of Andrew Scheer, Trudeau appeared to speak as though he won a majority government. And 2 days after, in a press conference, he appeared to be more conciliatory, saying he's aware of what happened on the prairies and that he already spoke to Premier Kenney and Premier Mo of Saskatchewan, as well as Mayor Naheed Nenshi of Calgary. He reassured the West that the Trans Mountain expansion will be built, and he wants to move forward in solving the challenges that Alberta faces of selling their oil below global market commodity prices. Now, time will tell what actions are taken, both in terms of policy and the makeup of cabinet, but put simply, the West needs action and not promises from this new government, and you can see this based on the actions that unfolded the day after the election. Following the election in Montreal, SNC-Lavalin shares spiked 13%, while Husky Energy laid off employees in Calgary. Husky isn't saying how many employees were affected, but employees who were talked to believe that the laid-off number in the hundreds. The West wants action, and they want it quickly. Separatist sentiments rose very quickly following the vote. The Facebook page VoteWexit.com had about 2,000 followers on Monday before polls closed, and its numbers today have since ballooned to 250,000 plus. And keep in mind, this is a Facebook page. It's not necessarily a scientific survey of how many people would support a potential separation referendum, but the sentiment that was expressed on Twitter throughout Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and now Friday, it hasn't let up, suggests that something needs to be done. Meanwhile, H plus K Strategies, which is a public relations firm that works out in New York, suggests that bots are behind the surge in separatist sentiment, when all you need to do is talk to anybody who works in the energy industry, lives in Calgary, or lives in rural Alberta, and they'll tell you that it is indeed a very real thing. The day after the election, Wexit Alberta said they received a notification from Facebook that their account was restricted. In particular, it stated that limits have been placed on the Wexit Alberta page, and stories from their page wouldn't be shown in the newsfeed any further, and this could be due to activities from your page that don't comply with Facebook's policy. Facebook, as per usual, hasn't responded to this comment, but to suggest bots are behind the Wexit surge is very premature. There also seems to be some irregularities on Google when searching for Wexit Alberta. Searching for Wexit Alberta, the Facebook page in particular, returns results about Wexit and various news stories, and a smaller Alberta Fights Back Facebook page. However, on Bing, the first result is indeed the VoteWexit.com Facebook page, as one would expect, the second being a global news story from back in August, when Wexit was founded, and third, a Calgary Sun article entitled "Liberal Win Stokes Talks of Wexit Separation for Alberta." This is indeed concerning, and while we have no way of knowing whether the Facebook page is being censored or if the Wexit page doesn't appear on Google for another reason, we want all our listeners to have the potential information about what could be happening with this going forward. And this is indeed concerning because we live in a world where information is what drives decisions, and the internet has been a great enabler since the 1990s in information sharing. So we hope that all parties, Facebook, Google, Bing, and the news organizations are acting honestly when it comes to this new drive towards people looking up what exactly Wexit means. The website wexitevents.com states that Wexit rallies will be planned in Edmonton, Calgary, and Red Deer on November 2nd, 16th, and 30th, respectively. Now, looking at what the other ramifications were in the media for this, Calgary commentator Danielle Smith suggested that Alberta take a page out of Quebec's book and ultimately become a nation within Canada. And this is something that we saw happen after the Quebec 1990s referendums on separation. She suggests that Alberta could create her own provincial police force, establish a tax department so we collect our own taxes and make it transparent just how much money is actually sent to Ottawa, and ultimately create our own immigration protocols so that we can meet the needs of our employers. Smith ultimately suggests many things that Kenny highlighted in his letter to Trudeau, but goes further and suggests that Alberta may go back in time to the 1903 borders and form one area of administration encompassing Alberta, Saskatchewan, and the Northwest Territories. The idea behind it is that it would create an economic juggernaut that would have to be listened to and Ottawa would be forced to negotiate with, and failing that, we could build pipelines and resource corridors through the north and use the Arctic for our deep-sea ports. These policies outline the very basis of reform conservatism that the Conservative Party of Canada was founded on, and the firewall letter of the early 2000s, signed by former Alberta Finance Minister Ted Morton, former Premier Ralph Klein, and former Prime Minister Stephen Harper, is something that we should all be looking at this point in time. Now, a note on separation. We have room to work here in Canada. There's a lot of anger in Alberta and Saskatchewan at this time. Canada is not a body that doesn't change. We're not bound by a 200-year-old constitution, as is the United States, and ultimately Canada is a young country filled with a young and growing population, especially in the West. Youthfulness brings change. Only time will tell where this country goes and the benefits of a reformed Canada that can ultimately benefit all Canadians. Jason Kenney touched on this, reiterating that he is completely against separation and appealed to Alberta patriotism, saying that the West should not let Justin Trudeau and his policies make us feel unwelcome in Canada, and that there are many allies for Alberta and Saskatchewan across the rest of the country in terms of other provincial governments. And to close this segment off, we're going to have a look at the words of former Prime Minister Stephen Harper that were spoken in 2011. Back in 2011, he said, "We're proud of Canada. Canada is and always has been our country. And we want Canada to be a strong, true north that is as strong and free as it can be in every way that matters, the best country in the world. Canada must reflect the true character of its people, honorable in its dealings and faithful to its commitments. Loyal to its friends, by turns a courageous warrior and a compassionate neighbor. It is our purpose that Canada must be great. It must be great for all Canadians, and it must be a country of hope and an example to the world. Only when it is these things, when Canada is all that it can be, Only then can we say that our work is done. And I think at that point, everybody who is listening to this in Western Canada should reflect on what Stephen Harper had to say in 2011, what Jason Kenney had to say this week, and ultimately actions that were looking at being taken in the early 2000s by Ralph Klein, Stephen Harper, and Ted Morton before we head down the path of separatism.
Yeah, exactly. There's going to be a lot of visceral anger from the election. The fact that the West voted overwhelmingly for the Conservatives, and yet, and the fact that the popular vote was won by the Conservatives, but indeed the Conservatives didn't win the most number of seats, and that it looks like Trudeau's still going to try and seek power. There's going to be a lot of anger from the West. We did the tabulation earlier on after election night and found that out of the 109 seats that are west of Northern Ontario, and including the territories, the Conservatives won 71 of them. And it's pretty clear that the West wanted there to be a change of government, and indeed there isn't a change of government. Even very, very liberal and NDP-friendly places of Winnipeg and Vancouver still went more conservative than they did in 2015, and indeed were more conservative than bigger cities out east of Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa, and Halifax. So there is going to be a lot of anger in the West, and a lot of that anger is going to be translated into knee-jerk reactions of separation and separatism, and certainly even perhaps joining the U.S., and a lot of people are going to think that way. But I think that a lot of it, they're going to have to put trust into their provincial governments, and hopefully at the end of the day, things will get better in the West, because Albertans in particular have felt that they've been kicked many times while they've been down over the last few years. And with Trudeau still trying to remain in power, it's going to feel like they're still not being heard. And at some point that anger and frustration turns into a different reaction. But at this point, we just have to keep calm, because Canada is still Canada at the end of the day, and we're still all Canadians, and we have to find a way to work together to get things done.
And, you know, so much is going to come from the reactions of Premiers Kenney and Premier Scott Moe in the next few months as this new potential government out east gets underway, and what the panel that talks to Albertans is going to hear and what they're going to suggest going forward on that front. And, you know, this is what we have to say as our podcast here, is that if this election isn't the result that you had hoped for, take note of when these consultations are happening in your community. Let Premier Kenney know and this panel exactly what is happening. And, you know, it's a minority government, and I think something to the effect that minority governments last on average 1.8 years in Canada. So I say to the rest in the West that we are going to have another chance to change things at some point in the not so distant future.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's important to note the differences between the 2015 election and the 2019 election. Though Quebec may have been a little bit different in terms of NDP flipping pretty much over to the Bloc, and, you know, certainly less vote share in the Atlantic provinces, but not the complete sweep that the Liberals had in 2015. And through Ontario, voting pretty much the same. The West showed there was much, much, much difference in the way that the vote totals spread over the last 4 years. So certainly Trudeau is aware that there needs to be something done. And whether he can do it or not is going to be dependent on whether his minority government can actually survive to do it.
Indeed, and that's going to be the hallmark of this new administration. So, election coverage aside, yes, it is still a regular Western Context episode. We actually do have news out of both BC and Alberta this week, lots of it, so we're going to carry on with that right now.
Yeah, exactly. And talking about BC, should be mentioned that even though BC voted more for the Liberals than any other party in 2015, this time it was the Conservatives who won the popular vote, and indeed the most seats in the province in BC, with 17 out of 42 going to the Conservatives, with 11 each for the NDP and Liberals, 2 to the Greens, and of course, Jody Wilson-Raybould. So there was definitely a lot more conservatism in parts of BC for sure. Now, Vancouver Island didn't change its seats whatsoever. We still have 2 Greens and 5 NDP on the island, but I wasn't really expecting much to change there. It seems like people here are indeed at least happy with the status quo, and the status quo seems to be going on in BC. Things don't seem to be changing too much in the way that Premier John Horgan says he's still going to try to work with Trudeau to better all Canadians, but there they still have their issues. And certainly one of the issues is going to crop up in this next BC story. And BC government has surprised us all by tabling a bill in the legislature that, if passed, would legally implement the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, otherwise known as UNDRIP. Now, since the province committed to the legislation more than a year ago, a team from the Ministry of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation has been working with the First Nations Leadership Council to draft the historic bill, which Premier John Horgan called, quote, a real catalyst for significant change. He went even further, saying that this bill is critically important because Indigenous rights are human rights. We all want to live in a province where the standard of living for Indigenous peoples is the same as every other human being in the province. Now, at the time of the bill being heard in the legislature, Indigenous leaders from across the province and across the country filled the gallery, some invited to sit on the floor of the central aisle, and those present represented the range of political leadership amongst Indigenous communities. There were elected MLAs, MPs, Jody Wilson-Raybould, and outgoing NDP MP Romeo Saganash, hereditary chiefs, elected chiefs, and elders. And the legislation is meant to provide a framework for the province to align its laws with the standards of the UN Declaration, which is something that Indigenous groups have long been advocating for in BC and across the country. Grand Chief Ed John, who is an Indigenous rights advocate, said, quote, what this declaration does is now recognize that Indigenous peoples have the inherent right to self-government and to make decisions and have power. John was involved with the development of the declaration as a representative for the Assembly of First Nations. He was in New York City when Canada formally opposed the declaration's adoption in the UN General Assembly back in 2007, and he was also there when Canada came back to the table in 2016 and endorsed it. Now, Scott Fraser, who is the BC Minister of Indigenous Relations, said that it was all about recognizing human rights of Indigenous peoples, and that, quote, governments of all stripes have not done before, despite the fact that it's in the Constitution of Canada. Fraser introduced the bill for a first reading on Thursday morning. He spoke about next steps and how the legislation provides a path forward in the government-to-government relationship between Indigenous peoples and the province. Now, it should be noted that this isn't the first time that someone has tried to pass a bill recognizing UNDRIP in Canada federally in 2016. Then Cree NDP MP Romeo Saganash, who decided to not run in this election, introduced Bill C-262 in Ottawa, which was described as, quote, an act to ensure the laws of Canada are in harmony with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Now, the bill passed in the House of Commons in 2018, but died earlier this year after getting held up in the Senate, so it did not become law. In 2015, Saganash sponsored private members Bill C-641, which was the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act, which would have required the Canadian government to ensure that the laws in Canada are in harmony with UNDRIP, but it was defeated on May 6, 2015. Now, there's still a chance that UNDRIP legislation will be brought forward again in Ottawa. Jody Wilson-Raybould, who is the newly elected independent MP and former Liberal cabinet minister, said that the country needs to create mechanisms to enable Indigenous peoples to be self-determining. She said, quote, it's something she will push for when she returns to Ottawa. Quote, I'm going to continue to be a strong voice to advocate for rights recognition in the country, much like the province of British Columbia is doing today. Now, in Jagmeet Singh's long-winded concession speech, which we have already talked about on Monday night, that sounded like a victory speech with a lot of dancing, despite losing almost half of the NDP caucus, Singh actually mentioned Indigenous rights specifically as something he would advocate for in the new minority parliament, so that might be an opening as well. Now, while the BC NDP government can boast of being the first at the provincial level with UNDRIP legislation, they are venturing into an area with far-reaching implications. The Declaration's 46 articles, enshrined by the UN a dozen years ago, cover social, health, education, cultural, religious, and self-government rights, among others. But for this province, with its vast base of land and resources, mostly unceded by First Nations, the most critical is Article 32, which is stated as, quote, Indigenous peoples have the right to determine and develop priorities and strategies for the development or use of their lands or territories and other resources. States shall consult and cooperate in good faith with the Indigenous peoples in order to obtain their free and informed consent prior to the approval of any project affecting their lands or territories and other resources. Now, other provisions heighten the stakes for BC and its more than 200 recognized First Nations. Article 28 grants Indigenous peoples, quote, the right to redress by means that can include restitution or, when this is not possible, just, fair, and equitable compensation for the lands, territories, and resources which they have been traditionally owned or otherwise occupied and used, and which have been confiscated, taken, occupied, used, or damaged without their free, prior, and informed consent. Now, given the absence of treaties over most of BC, the lands, territories, and resources that have, in the past couple hundred years, have been confiscated, taken, occupied, used, or damaged without free, prior, and informed consent, could constitute pretty much the entire province. Now, here's what the UN Declaration has to say about remedies. It says, quote, compensation shall take the form of lands, territories, and resources equal in quality, size, and legal status, or of monetary compensation or other appropriate redress, which, once again, is pretty much the entire province. Now, in defense of the legislation, the NDP are assembling experts to validate the decision Thursday and play down the implications. Horgan is always already on record as insisting that, quote, free, prior, and informed consent, as stated in UNDRIP, is not the same as a veto. But on other occasions, he has sounded two-faced on the issue. In opposing the expansion of Trans Mountain Pipeline, he has insisted that it is not enough that many First Nations along the route have supported the project. He said, quote, I just reject the notion that this is a majority rule situation, which in doing so implies that every Aboriginal rights and title holder along the route does have a veto, and that majority rule doesn't apply. At the same time, he brushed aside that view with opposition to Site C from two of the Treaty 8 First Nations, and he said that shouldn't be enough to halt construction of the hydroelectric dam on the Peace River. And certainly the PC government is trying to push ahead with the Coastal GasLink's natural gas pipeline from Dawson Creek to Kitimat, BC, despite a very small minority of First Nations along the route being very much opposed to it. So it begs the question as to where Horgan's majority rule situation, how far does that exactly go? And we don't really have the answers to this. So at this critical juncture in Canadian politics, after a divisive election that led to a parliament amid growing Western alienation as well as a rise of support for the separatist Bloc Québécois, this will throw another wrench into the plans of those who support our natural resource industry. The threat of a First Nations veto could kill any major interprovincial infrastructure project like the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion, which the newly reduced Trudeau caucus says that they will still fight for. With BC's UNDRIP, one segment of the population is very much elated, and much of the rest of the population will likely be worried about things to come.
The UN declarations on things such as UNDRIP and various other agendas that the UN put forward are abstract in nature, and in general, when a piece of legislation or a treaty or a declaration is abstract in nature, it invites the implementing area to implement it in a way that works for them. But on the other hand, sometimes you have governments, and I think the Horgan NDP government might be one that proceeds down this path, is where they will take the UNDRIP manifesto from the UN and implement it exactly as it was being hoped it would be implemented, which, as been outlined here, could spell many potential stumbling blocks for natural resource projects and just in general land ownership in BC. And we need to be clear here in that anytime we're talking about negotiating with the Indigenous people of Canada, whether it be in BC, Alberta, or anywhere else in the country, the solution taken needs to be one that is tailored to that specific province and tailored to the specific need at the time. Personally, legislating on UNDRIP is probably not the best way to go. And there are perhaps made in Canada solutions that can work better. And turning back to the election, I believe it was Elizabeth May who said that she would like to eventually replace Canada's Indian Act, which on its own has been used as a model of for apartheid in South Africa. And when you think about it in that front, we're looking here at the 21st century, we're looking at an act that goes back to the 1800s, and maybe rather than rushing to implement something like UNDRIP, it's time to come up with a Canadian-made at-home solution.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think anyone wants to say that Indigenous governments don't have the right to self-government and don't have the right to control what their territories are. But unfortunately, in BC, it's a much more different than that, because there are more recognized First Nations in BC than there are in the rest of the country combined, practically. There are more than 200 of them here, and their territories overlap to pretty much overlap the entire province, in the sense that not only is one territory could be claimed by one First Nation, anywhere up to five or even more First Nations could claim that territory. And if some of them oppose a certain project and some of them support a certain project, would it mean that the ones that don't support the project that have their territory that claims a particular part of their project, does that mean that they have a right to say that that can't go through? And if UNDRIP goes through, does that mean that they have the right to say no to it? And I believe it was Perry Bellegarde, who was the chief of the Assembly of First Nations, who said that yes means yes and no means no. So if they say no, does that mean the project can't go through? And it's going to raise a lot of questions going forward as to what actually can get built in the province. And I think Horgan has opened up a huge can of worms with this issue just because of that issue. If there was a lot of treaties like there are in most of other parts of Canada, it certainly would be a more cut and dried issue. But I think in BC especially, it's going to be quite dangerous going forward, in the sense that we don't know what can actually happen.
Indeed. And, you know, we look at these things being simple on the surface, but this is opening up something that can potentially lead to a lot more complicated lawsuits, a lot of complicated legislations, and potentially have an impact countrywide. So we'll definitely be watching this one closely. And, you know, we're going to wrap this show up in a little bit. I realize this is another longer episode of Western Context, but we do have to talk about the Alberta budget still. But before we do that, I'll just take a moment to remind our listeners of our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/Western Context. And there's where you can support the podcast monetarily if you so choose. For $2 a month or the price of a cup of coffee, you help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month at the price of a sandwich, you continue to help us do that and can have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you become a Western Context insider and gain insight into our work and gain access to our show notes and production throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. At $50 a month, we'll host online town halls every quarter Topics of discussion will include the news of the month, the state of the media, and your questions. Secondly, if you want to make a one-time contribution, you can do that as well via PayPal. You can find out more about the PayPal option and our Patreon offerings at westerncontext.ca/support. All right, so this week on Thursday, it was Budget Day in Alberta, and this is the first budget brought forward by the new United Conservative government, and this budget is remarkable in ways that this is the first budget since 2007 to bring in spending restraint to the province of Alberta. This starts the path to the province balancing the books in time for the next election in 2023. The budget brings in spending restraint and cuts by the order of 2.8% each year for the next 4 years. Contrary to what the opposition NDP think, this budget is nowhere near the cuts of the infamous, or famous for some, 1993 Ralph Klein budget. And just as a point of comparison, the 93 budget under Ralph Klein was cutting on the order of 18% per year, and that's about nine times as less drastic than what we're seeing today, or rather, today is nine times less drastic than 93. The budget reaffirms the axing of the provincial carbon tax and outlines the plan to continue reducing the corporate tax rate to an eventual 8%. By 2022, Alberta will have a combined provincial and federal corporate tax rate of 23%. This ranks seventh overall in North America, with the lowest being 21% in Texas, Washington, South Dakota, Ohio, and Nevada. Economists have estimated that this tax cut will create 55,000 new jobs and grow Alberta's economy by $13 billion. The savings for this budget will be made by cutting the public sector by 7.7% over 4 years, resulting in 1,588 jobs cut across government. Education spending is untouched, while health spending increases by 1%. Post-secondary spending is being cut by 5% with an additional 6% cut in 2022-23. As we've talked about before, the province's post-secondary institutions were indeed worried about this, but we've outlined areas where they can indeed trim the fat. 32% of the 2019 capital plan will go to cities for a total of $7.7 billion, and the cities will need to find savings as the MSI, or Municipal Sustainability Initiative framework, is being reworked and slimmed down, as the amount of money that cities receive right now is 20% higher than Canada's average. The new framework replacing MSI and the Calgary and Edmonton $500 million City Charter's Fiscal Framework Act will be worth $860 million in 2022-23, with $455 million going to both cities of Edmonton and Calgary and $405 million for other municipalities. The province is also delaying the funding of the new LRT projects in Edmonton and Calgary until after 2022-23. And this caused Mayor Don Iveson of Edmonton to cancel a planned trip abroad, calling an emergency council meeting to plan the path forward. Now, recall back to September where the McKinnon report was clear in that all areas of public service in Alberta, including municipalities, need to look for saving. The very fact Don Iveson is concerned about this shows that the city is spending too much and relying too much on provincial funding. Iveson said that I've had this expectation that because it was in the UCP platform, it was secure. Iveson also said that he was very disappointed to find out without any warning that this changed. He said that Edmonton residents face falling behind on infrastructure or paying more in municipal debt interest payments or both. Here at Western Context, we've talked about the waste at the city level before, from bike lanes that go in only to be ripped out, LRT as an economic driver, highlighted by Councillor Tim Cartmell last year, when there's no guarantee that the new LRT corridor will spur economic growth, and the ever-increasing property taxes in Edmonton on both homeowners and businesses, while our roads and sidewalks are in a state of decay, even while the city of Edmonton has been spending a great amount of money. Nobody should be surprised by this budget. The media, the opposition NDP, union activists, or even Albertans. This is what was in the United Conservative Party platform. And in fact, Albertans talked to by CTV News and Rural Alberta were pleased to see this budget because this is what everyday Albertans have to do when they're looking at balancing their own budgets. Back while in opposition on the radio, Kenny was asked ultimately about new funding for a project in Calgary, and his answer was simple. He just said, no, we're broke, and that's what this budget illustrates. In a primetime address on Wednesday, Kenny made the point that businesses and households need to balance their budgets and live within their means, and can't keep paying for purchases with the credit card while not paying that credit card down. He understands that he was elected on a mandate to reduce spending, balance the budget, and ultimately create jobs. And as columnist Rick Bell wrote in the Calgary Sun, he, being Kenny, is not afraid of the scissors, and if things get worse, the province will need sharper scissors. Now, this budget, of course, did suck a lot of the oxygen out of the media coverage this week in Alberta, but there are two other pieces of news that we need to touch on very quickly here. First and foremost, Drayden Valley Devon MLA Mark Smith introduced Bill 204, known as the Election Recall Act, which fulfills a UCP election promise that will allow any eligible Alberta voter to initiate a recall petition to fire their MLA. This can only happen 18 months after an election, and the verified non-digital signatures of 40% of eligible voters in a constituency will be needed. The petitioners will be limited to a 60-day campaign period to collect all the signatures, and failing any of these cases will end the recall drive. Also breaking on Friday afternoon, a jury found Abdouli Al-Sharif guilty on all charges, including 5 counts of attempted murder. Sharif was the terrorist who ran down several people, including EPS Constable Mike Chernik on September 30th of 2017. The attack mirrored attacks that we saw in Europe carried out by other ISIS sympathizers, and back in 2017, it was reported that the police found an ISIS flag in the car, but terrorism charges were not laid, and the word terrorism was never mentioned to the jury. Former Edmonton Police Chief Rod Connect is on record as saying that the device that they found with Sharif was encrypted and posed a barrier. He said that if we could have accessed the device, it would have pushed the investigation forward. It would have demonstrated who else was involved, because in situations where it looked like there was only one person involved, oftentimes there was someone else who helped along the journey. And for what it's worth in mentioning this, Sharif has been his own defendant. He hasn't used a lawyer, and he hasn't responded to anything that the court said throughout the entire trial. Due to encryption, the Canadian justice system, or some combination of both, we have just proven that terrorists can now get away with only an attempted murder charge here in Canada. And quite frankly, that's not the outcome that Canadians wanted to hear.
No, that's absolutely the case. And I think a lot of people would be surprised to note that it was pretty clear that he was an ISIS, that the terrorist act was supported by ISIS, and indeed the terrorist himself supported ISIS, but yet there was no charges of terrorism, there was no charges based on that, just attempted murder. And the fact that that was the case didn't matter that he was guilty on all the charges that he was charged on. I think a lot of people were very surprised by that, certainly. And I think going back to the further thing by being surprised by the budget, when it was indeed the case that the UCP were going to try to bring the budget back into balance, and in doing so, that means you need to cut down on unnecessary spending. And this is something that we've seen that the federal government certainly can't do very well, and something that the provincial government in BC has been able to do over the last few years. So it certainly should be possible for Alberta to balance its budget, and a lot of the universities and the municipal governments that are complaining about reduced spending should critically look at their own finances and see where they can actually make up that money, because a lot of municipal funding comes from the province. It means that they're going to have to take a look at what they can actually spend money on. And this will take a lot of time for the councils to do a lot of soul searching to figure out what they can do on this issue.
Indeed. And, you know, the whole idea behind the budget is to bring per capita spending, that is the amount that government spends effectively per person in Alberta, down to a level of similar to BC or Ontario, and in doing so will fix a lot of the spending problems that this government sees. And as we move forward on this, this is going to be one path the government is going to be pushing forward on, but they're also going to be pushing forward on the path of standing up for Alberta and preventing a potential Wexit. And that leads us nicely into our word of the week.
Yes, that's right. So our word of the week this week is Wexit, which before the last couple of weeks, a lot of people probably wouldn't have heard of this one. It's a play on the European term Brexit, which of course has been around for a few years now, in reference to Britain leaving the European Union. Wexit refers to a movement of an undetermined amount of Western Canadian provinces, usually Alberta and Saskatchewan, to separate from Canada. It also refers to a growing sense of Western alienation amongst those in Western Canada, and we've certainly seen that from the results on Monday of the election that showed that Justin Trudeau appeared to have the numbers to still govern the country, which we will, of course, find out upon reconvening Parliament. But a lot of people in the West were very upset by this, and certainly this Wexit was one of the conclusions that a lot of people were drawn to, especially on social media, where the term Wexit blew up on Facebook and Twitter. And we'll have to see how this goes. Of course, it seems that cooler heads may yet prevail and that the provincial governments might have something to say on the matter. But certainly before this last week, Wexit wasn't really a term that many people heard, but it's certainly now into the common parlance.
Indeed. And, you know, if you want to see any of our supplementary sources, the responses from Jason Kenney or any of the results from this week's election, you can find all of that in our supplemental notes at westerncontext.ca. This is definitely a week you'll want to go there. And if you haven't seen a map of Canada after the election result, we'll have that too as the picture of the week. And, you know, you can also subscribe to the podcast on our website at westerncontext.ca/subscribe on pretty much any podcast listener out there. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share the show and more throughout the entire week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all of these stories that the media will be talking about and some that they won't be talking about now that the election is over and things to go back to normal in the news cycle. We're going to be looking at everything to make sure that you can cut through all that bias and sensationalism that we always see in mainstream media, no matter what the topic is about, it seems, just so that you have the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.